Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday. Yay, it's Friday, September 2nd, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is 64 degrees and sunny here in upstate New York. Should be a beautiful beginning of September weekend. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Biological Insanity, Drinking Water, Superbugs, and the Crazy New Virus. And yes, we talked about the Crazy New Virus. That's what they called it. I don't know, it was some insane name that broke all laws of infection. Just showed up in mosquitoes, how interestingly so. We spent a lot of time over the last week or two talking about being able to CRISPR and create mad science gone mad. And I thought today for a Friday, we might listen to an interview. This interview happens to be a gentleman named Edward Hammond. Edward Hammond, according to Wiki, is a scientist. He was born in 1968 and is an American policymaker who, from 1999 through 2007, served as the director of the United States Office of the Sunshine Project. He was managing its research program on biodefense, incapacitants, and other issues. Edward Hammond's research relies heavily on government records obtained through the U.S. Freedom of Information Act and other open government laws. His requests revealed Pentagon non-lethal weapons research of questionable legality, ding, under biological and chemical weapons laws, as well as major flaws in institutional biosafety committees, biosafety and security lapses at Texas A&M University, which I did not know about, and a notorious U.S. Air Force proposal to develop the gay bomb. And I don't know if you remember that, but that was quite a few years back. His research has been published by the Sunshine Project in a peer-reviewed journal and by news media. Edward Hammond began his work on biotechnology-related policy in the early 1990s and was program director for the Rural Advancement Foundation International, also known as the RAFI, from 1995 to 1999. Hammond was also a member of the Pugwash Study Group of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Convention and the Freedom of Information Foundation of Texas. Currently, after the suspension of the Sunshine Project in early 2008, Hammond has divided his time between Texas and Bogota, Colombia. His recent work focused on issues including destruction of the smallpox virus stocks and pandemic influenza preparedness, particularly reform of the WHO Global Influenza Surveillance Network. He also maintains two public websites, one dedicated to influenza-related policy issues called Immunocompetent, and the other to biodefense research in Texas. And there's a lot of crazy stuff going on there. The latter, named the Biodefense Barbecue, pokes fun at biodefense laboratories by claiming to be the website of the, quote, Texas Biodefense Alliance, a fictitious coalition of flunkies who have found unlikely success by dedicating themselves to government grants for biodefense research. And, you know, like I said, they are all out to get published because that's the name of the game. If you're published, you can become rich and famous. So anyway, we're going to play an interview today. It's going to take up the whole show, but it's a really, really good one. This is with Edward Hammond. And at the time, he was the director, or just the former director, of the Sunshine Project. They listed as an organization focusing on oversight of research involving biological weapons agents. I am taking this off of a YouTube channel for Talking Stick TV. And Talking Stick TV is a Seattle community media channel. I will link to this in the notes. It's a really good interview. So enjoy. You guys all have a good holiday weekend. And hopefully, I'll catch up with you on Monday. All right, everybody, take care.
We are talking today with Ed Hammond. He is the director of the U.S. Office of the Sunshine Project. If you would begin, start out and tell us about the Sunshine Project.
Sure. We're a small nonprofit group with offices in the U.S. and in Germany, and we were founded back in 1999 to work on issues of biological warfare and biological weapons. I spend most of my time working to track the U.S. biodefense program and the expansion of high containment facilities and the types of research that go on inside of them. Also work a bit on so-called non-lethal weapons, and fairly engaged in at the United Nations and the World Health Organization and the Biological Weapons Convention, trying to see if we can get those organizations to do some work in terms of safety.
And how do you go about choosing which particular aspects of the biodefense program to focus on?
Well, it's so huge, there's no shortage of potential areas of interest. To a certain extent, the biodefense research, to a large extent, has to take place inside of facilities that are constructed to contain the rather dangerous organisms that they use. So tracking the labs themselves, and these would be what are called biosafety level 3 and biosafety level 4 labs, is important because these are the only places that really the bugs like anthrax or Ebola can be handled without, in effect, great personal risk. Having said that, even within those facilities, there are accidents that occur relatively frequently. So it's a matter of tracking facilities, and to an extent also looking at the federal budget and looking at federal grants and seeing what money is going where for what purposes, because there are some kinds of biodefense research that can be relatively innocuous. There are other types that might involve, for example, genetic engineering of a pathogen, or studies that would involve deliberately preparing them in a way to mimic their use as a weapon. And those things are much more controversial and dangerous.
So you recently testified before the U.S. Congress. What was the circumstances surrounding that? What did you talk about?
Well, the House Commerce and Energy and Commerce Committee, which is chaired by John Dingell from Michigan, has taken an interest in the expansion of biodefense labs in the United States. We've gone from having a relatively small number of facilities that actively handle biological weapons agents to having more than 400 in the United States now, and this explosion has taken place in a period of only 6 or 7 years. And there's a growing sense, and I believe that some members of Congress and the Government Accountability Office, GAO, have looked at it, that we are posing a greater danger to ourselves by continuing to proliferate the number of places and the number of people that are handling these agents, and that as much or potentially even more than the risk of a possible foreign bioterrorist, that we may breed problems at home by continuing to spread this stuff across the country.
What kind of numbers are we looking at in terms of this recent proliferation?
Well, first of all, whenever this issue comes up, I think the first thing to say is that it's extremely difficult to know. The Centers for Disease Control and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which manage oversee laboratories that handle these types of agents, release very, very, very little information to the public. So we have to depend upon shards of information here and there. According to the latest of what they've said, we have about 410, 415 laboratories in the United States where biological weapons agents are handled, and more than 15,000 people. Having said that, how you count a lab is a bit of a of a difficult question if you have two labs, in the same building. Is it one or is it two? So when GAO, the Government Accountability Office, looked at the question, they concluded that we have, they don't know, but thousands of biosafety level three facilities in the U.S. How many of those, by the way that they count, are handling biological weapons agents is unclear, because frankly there is no single government agency that is in charge of tracking these high containment labs. So there's no clear answer to your question, which is, I think, one of the problems that's troubling Congress.
And how do you define biological weapons agents?
Well, there's sort of a nice bureaucratic term that's used for them, which is select agent. That's what we say in law. But what in fact it means is biological weapons agent. And really, these are the diseases that have historically been explored in offensive biological weapons programs in the United States or in the former Soviet Union, or in other countries. Europe, the UK, Canada, Japan have also had programs at one time or another. So it's the agents that historically were looked at to be weaponized, or in some cases some of the new emerging diseases that clearly have potential to be weaponized should someone want to do it, something like Ebola or Marburg. But generally speaking, the diseases that would be candidates to use in biological warfare are those that have a very low infectious dose. So in other words, a very small exposure is likely to result in disease. Those that can be prepared in such a way that's suitable to transmit by aerosol, so things that basically can waft through the air to infect people.
Where is the bulk of the funding for this work coming from?
Almost all the funding for work on biological weapons agents in the U.S. is provided by the federal government. Within the federal government, there are major chunks of money coming out of the Department of Health and Human Services, the National Institutes of Health, Department of Energy, and the Department of Defense, and the Department of Homeland Security. Having said that, there are as many as 12 or 14 federal agencies that have bits and pieces of biodefense research. In effect, what happened is that after 2001, there was something of a struggle between government agencies to decide who would get the lion's share of biodefense funding, and one of the winners was the National Institutes of Health, in part on the theory that if the money went to NIH, that NIH would be less likely to spend it in ways that resulted in problems than if we gave the money to the Department of Defense. But I think experience has shown that the influx of biodefense money into the National Institutes of Health has, to a significant extent, corrupted their normal peer review processes. So you can gain access to biodefense money more easily than you could by traditional means at NIH. The unfortunate reality that we're dealing with now is that our National Institutes of Health has OCA, Original Classification Authority, and although they use it less frequently than some other government agencies, NIH has not proven immune to the kinds of secrecy and security concerns that you would typically associate more with the Department of Homeland Security or the Army.
So the recent proliferation of funding and these labs came from what event?
Well, the real trigger were the anthrax letters following 9/11, and it was that focused, I think, Americans' minds on bioterrorism in a way that really hadn't happened before. There had been sort of some folks in and out of government in the late 90s and 2000 that that were concerned about it, but it really wasn't until the anthrax letters that we multiplied our funding by a factor of about 10 in this area.
And whatever came of the investigations into that incident?
Well, they officially remain open. The leading, you know, theory that the FBI appears to be following, and that certainly has, you know, the one that has the most credibility among people who have tried to investigate the anthrax letters, is that they were sent by a person that was either affiliated with or had some connection to a U.S. biodefense lab, which is quite possibly the way by which they obtained both the anthrax strain itself and the knowledge of how to prepare it. Certainly the strain that was used in the anthrax letters was one that was mainly in use in U.S. biodefense labs. So the irony is the theory would be that it was a person who was very concerned about bioterrorism and perhaps obsessed with dangerous bugs, and who wanted to provoke a reaction and provoke people's concern about bioterrorism. And if that's true, then they certainly were tremendously successful, because the budgets went through the roof for this type of research. And a culprit has never been identified or indicted.
So what is the real problem with this massive increase in funding and increase in number of labs?
Well, there are problems that operate at several levels. First of all, there are problems with the possibility of an escape of agent from the labs themselves. So you could have, either through an accident or through a deliberate act by a laboratory employee, you could have an outbreak of disease. That's one set of problems, which is a pretty severe one. Another set of problems is what this is doing to the biological scientists in the United States. I am very dismayed and concerned that areas of science which historically have not been subjected to a sort of national security mentality are suddenly being flooded with and becoming subservient to the sort of national security apparatus. And this wasn't the case in infectious disease research until very recently. So I think there's some insidious effects that we don't really even understand yet on infectious disease research. And a third area is what this means in the long run in terms of security with our relationship with other countries. And we have what is far and away the largest program to study biological weapons agents in the world, in the United States. And our example is leading other countries to invest heavily in these kinds of facilities and this kind of research. And the nature of biodefense research is that it's dual use. And what that means is that some of the things that you do might yield useful information for how to defend yourself, but they're going to yield useful information for how to wage warfare at the same time. And with so much suspicion between countries around the world, this has the real potential to lead us into a biodefense race. And a biodefense race is very, very difficult to distinguish from a bio-offense race, because the research is very closely related. Or another way to think about that, another way to put it would be that things are happening now in biodefense laboratories in the United States every day that, were they to happen in a lab in Tehran, we would never believe that this was with a defensive intent, and we very well might bomb Iran for doing things that we are perfectly comfortable with doing ourselves in our own labs. And that kind of double standard and this, those kinds of, that kind of mutual suspicion coupled with this huge investment in new facilities, is could lead us to a very undesirable future in terms of countries trying to outdo one another with respect to research into the dark or the bad potential of biotechnology.
Have you found in your research any direct connection in the funding between the increase in these biodefense facilities and the closing of, for instance, across the country of EPA, FDA labs, and, for instance, USDA inspectors?
I haven't looked at it broadly across the government in that way. One thing that I have done is taken a look at funding for infectious disease research from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. This is the unit of the National Institutes of Health. And if one does a comparison of 1999 to 2001, the pre-biodefense boom years, against what happened in the three subsequent years, what you can see is that funding for research on a lot of diseases that that Americans typically die of or that typically are infected with, sexually transmitted diseases like gonorrhea, any of the various numbers, Lyme disease and other types of infectious diseases, has either stayed flat or, in fact, gone down a bit. And funding of basic research, these would be research on model organisms to understand basic mechanisms that are common to many different types of microbes, has gone down a bit, while research into biological weapons agents, which typically exact a very, very, very low toll, natural death toll among Americans, has gone through the roof, going up by 2,000%. So certainly the biodefense boom has not helped, and in some cases actually appears to be linked to a decline in funding of research on things that Americans actually contract and in some cases die from.
It's interesting. I had just aired recently a talk, and I can't remember who the speaker was, and he had done analysis of what people die of in Africa and had charts showing that, in fact, the bulk of what people die from is not from infectious diseases. It's from common things that, for instance, hit us here in the U.S. as well, like heart disease, malnutrition, intestinal problems, things like that. It was just interesting.
Yeah, early on, and I think that even NIH, you can see this surface sometimes. Occasionally, you will see biodefense researchers attempt to justify or attempt to explain, research on some kind of bizarre infectious diseases like Ebola or Marburg. And I should say there's no reason why we shouldn't have some research in that area. We've just gone over the top, but by saying that this is going to help poor Africans. And if you really assess it, this is a preposterous argument, because first of all, in terms of public health investment, if you talk to African health ministers and health leaders, it's not a cure for these diseases that very few people contract that they're looking for. It's more basic public health. Basic clean water, for example, would be far more helpful. And even if one, setting that aside, if you look at the types of treatments that could result, may result eventually from biodefense research, the economics of them simply don't work for use in the developing world. A very brand new, expensive Ebola vaccine, if that eventually happens, and that's a very big if, it's the costs associated with it and the logistics of actually providing it are at this point, no one has anything approaching a solution to that. So the notion that that some of this research on unusual diseases that primarily affect people in developing countries is going to be a sort of odd combination of U.S. national security work and foreign aid really falls flat on its face, because if you look at it, there's just no way that these things would be delivered in our current system to the actual benefit of those people.
So getting back to the facilities where this work is being done and the labs, where physically and what institutions or organizations are building these?
Well, there's a mix. The government itself, in some instances, is building biodefense or new biodefense facilities. There's a concentration of them around Fort Detrick in Maryland, which was the historical home of the U.S. offensive biological weapons program, which ended in 1969. And there are other federal facilities that have been commissioned and are going to be built and operated by the federal government. But there are even more facilities that are being paid for by the federal budget but are being constructed by either private institutions, research institutions, or universities. And if you look at the numbers of labs being constructed, it's this latter group of the university and research institute labs that are larger. Certainly in terms of square footage at biosafety level 3, and still a little bit of an open question, perhaps not. Perhaps the government may have more biosafety level 4 square footage, but it's this push out from the government into other areas of research that's relatively new. Historically, it's been the government that has operated these kinds of facilities, and now more and more it's other types of institutions.
So what is the safety track record for institutions and facilities like this?
Well, the first thing that people should know is that we decided back in the 1970s not to regulate laboratory biosafety in the United States, and we still don't regulate laboratory biosafety in the United States. Some of the riskiest research historically took place at Fort Detrick in Maryland and at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, which are government-operated labs with a very sort of strict command and control system associated with them. This is not the culture that one encounters at a university, for example, or at a research institute. So what we have now is a huge expansion of these labs, and really only a hodgepodge of bits and pieces of rules here and there coming from the federal level or in some cases from the state level, but there's no comprehensive regulation of the facilities. The backbone of oversight of these facilities in the U.S. is supposed to be a system called the Institutional Biosafety Committee System. And these are local committees composed of professors or researchers, and in some cases safety staff, who are supposed to oversee research projects to make sure that there aren't accidents and that folks exercise good judgment in what they're doing in the facilities. And having looked very, very intensely at the Institutional Biosafety Committee System since 2003, I'm very confident in saying that the committee system is in no shape whatsoever to safely handle this expansion in biodefense research. What I've found is that the committees frequently don't exist or only exist on paper. They don't meet. They don't review projects. They don't, in some cases, even, the institutions aren't even aware of what the requirements allegedly are that are upon them. So in terms of federal oversight, it's a big mess right now. And that's one thing that I hope that we don't have to have a catastrophic lab accident before something happens to improve the situation.
What data did you look at in coming to your conclusions about IBCs?
Well, I have conducted two national surveys of IBCs. They operate under what are called the NIH guidelines. So it's not a federal rule system, but it's a federal suggestion. And allegedly, under either through contractual obligations or in some cases through regulations, laboratories in the United States, most of them that receive federal funding, are allegedly required to follow these guidelines. And in the guidelines, there are public access provisions that say that when the committees meet, they're supposed to take minutes, and those minutes are supposed to be available to the public. So I asked basically all the committees in the United States in 2003 and again in 2006 to provide their institutional biosafety committee minutes. To be quite honest, my initial intent in doing that was to see how good their disclosure was, because one of the things that I believe is that by having a really strong culture of transparency at labs, we're going to be safer. If the public can look over the shoulder of these labs, we're going to be safer. So I anticipated getting into a fight with laboratories about the quality of their disclosure. But what I discovered instead was that the entire committee system was dysfunctional. As I said, that committees didn't meet and that they weren't working. So rather than going into a debate over what level of detail should be released about an anthrax project, for example, at a state university, what wound up happening was I got into a fight with institutions over whether or not they should have committees and why their committees were failing to review the projects to begin with.
So do institutions that are not receiving NIH funding, are they required to participate in the whole concept of IBCs?
No, and it's a tremendous gap in our system, which is not a very good system to begin with. But presently, if an institution does not receive funding for genetic engineering research, or recombinant DNA is the other term used for it, from the federal government, then they are not required to operate one of these institutional biosafety committees. It is said by industry that the group of labs that fall most into that category, i.e. the ones that don't have federal funding, are industry. Industry says that it complies with these guidelines voluntarily. But in asking the industry for committee minutes, and in assessing the quality of their response, my estimate is that well below 10% of the biotech industry, as well as the big pharma industry, actually comply with the federal guidelines. So in effect, with only a few exceptions, the private sector does not even fall under this voluntary guideline system. They are operating beyond any semblance of federal oversight.
And then do the institutions that are receiving NIH funding, do they send their meeting minutes into the NIH, and then are those reviewed?
No. To be perfectly honest, the National Institutes of Health has no interest whatsoever in operating an effective biosafety committee system. The only thing that the institutions actually send to NIH is a list of the members of their committee with a resume. The committee minutes themselves are almost never submitted to NIH. There's no requirement to do so. In fact, again and again, I have filed complaints with the National Institutes of Health about committees that were refusing to produce their IBC minutes. And even when NIH is aware of a dysfunctional committee and one that is won't respond to public requests, they still won't ask the committee for its minutes. The view is, I think, in at least among some people in Washington, is that this research should be the private business, or is the private business of these institutions. But if you talk about biodefense, research is overwhelmingly publicly funded. So that view really doesn't wash, and I think it shouldn't wash. We certainly have a right to know what types of research are taking place at labs, particularly if it's publicly funded. But even if it's not publicly funded, it's universally acknowledged that biotech research poses risks to the community. That's why these committees exist to begin with, is because there are inherent risks in this research. And I believe that communities have a right to know, and that by exercising and by holding up that right to know, we'll ultimately have a safer system. Because if the labs know that someone's looking over their shoulder, they're more apt to behave responsibly.
So what happens at these institutions when accidents occur?
Well, I believe, and I don't say this lightly, but having looked very carefully at the oversight of labs for a number of years now, I believe that there's a culture of denial in the United States about lab accidents. The first thing to know is that there are few federal reporting requirements. So a frustrating thing for me has been that again and again across the country, when you see new biodefense labs proposed, the proponents of the labs will say, there's very little medical literature on laboratory accidents, and so therefore they imply laboratory accidents don't happen. That's not true. What it is that laboratory accidents are not reported. And there have been some rather well-reported and interesting cases that have emerged. First in 2004 in Boston, where Boston University, which is building a giant new biosafety level 4 lab, failed to report to the community that three of its researchers were contracted tularemia, which is a biological weapons disease, in the BU labs. And in fact, those researchers were not supposed to be handling virulent tularemia to begin with. So the presence of the agent at all in the laboratory was at that point not authorized by the federal government. And in fact, we've never gotten a clear story about how that happened. Three researchers infected with a bug that wasn't supposed to be in the lab. This is where the lack of transparency on the part of the federal government comes into play, because the feds certainly would have looked into that. And, I believe that it's quite likely that they have chosen not to publicize the fact that BU researchers probably violated federal law and were handling agents that they were not permitted to do so. In other cases, my organization, the Sunshine Project, has spent quite a bit of time earlier this year looking at Texas A&M University. And what we found there were a number of problems, including a researcher that contracted Brucella, in fact, a pretty serious case of Brucella. And not only was it not reported to the public, they failed to report it to the federal government, as in that case it was required by law. So the culture is really one that encourages institutions to cover up what happens when bad things happen in labs, for fear of either a public backlash or fear of losing access to federal funding because the infections or other accidents reflect badly on their facilities. And we've got to overcome this, because it's obviously a dangerous situation when facilities are either not reporting because there's no requirement, or in the case of Texas A&M, and I believe probably others, ignoring federal law and not reporting lab problems.
Talk more about the situation at Texas A&M. It's my understanding that in your investigations, after you found that initial mention of that exposure, that you found out there'd been more exposures there going over a period of about 4 years?
Yeah, you know, and this is why I think open records law and freedom of information laws are so important. Basically, I requested all of Texas A&M's records on lab accidents with significantly dangerous agents over a period of years, and they produced one very curious piece of paper that was obviously an extremely incomplete answer. And really, over a period of months of applying pressure on them under this was in Texas, so the Texas Public Information Act, and actually even getting the local district attorney into the act, eventually Texas A&M was forced to cough up what are now about 3,000 pages of records, all but one page of which they denied the existence of initially. And what it revealed was really a horror story. In addition to the unreported serious Brucella incident, there had been several other researchers who had positive blood tests to exposure to Brucella, and also an agent called Q fever. When CDC went in to investigate, and CDC only went in to investigate because the Sunshine Project had extracted this information under the Texas Public Information Act, so the federal oversight had failed to detect all of these problems. They found even more, and basically that there were unauthorized experiments involving genetic engineering of biological weapons agents. There were persons who had no training, no appropriate experience handling them. There were people who did not have federal permits who were handling them. So at this point, I guess that investigation reflected very, very badly on Texas A&M. It also reflected very, very badly on the Centers for Disease Control, because these were major violations of procedure, major violations of even in some cases law about how these facilities were supposed to operate. And the Centers for Disease Control had kept issuing basically positive inspection reports at Texas A&M. And it really wasn't until the district attorney in Brazos County, Texas, told Texas A&M that she was considering bringing their officials up before a grand jury if they didn't cough up the records that this became apparent. So, you know, at this point, Texas A&M and Department of Health and Human Services are in a bizarre dance that I don't really understand of determining the fee or basically the fine that A&M will pay. Theoretically, they are up for well in excess of $10 million, and the possibility still exists of criminal indictments of a number of their officials, particularly for the failure to report the lab infections, as well as the fact that they repeatedly permitted unauthorized people to handle these agents.
So during this, prior to these latest visits by the CDC, CDC had done visits there and had come up with nothing?
Yeah, the typical procedure when CDC inspects a lab, and this is what happened in Texas A&M, let me step back for a minute. Actually, the typical procedure is that nobody ever finds out anything about it, because everything related to inspections of facilities by CDC, facilities that handle biological weapons agents, is stamp sensitive but unclassified. And if you file a Freedom of Information Act request for it, you are automatically denied. This is an issue that's ripe for federal litigation, but unfortunately my organization doesn't have the means to do that. But so the first answer to your question is we don't know, because they keep all of it secret. But we have been able to get inside these inspections in some cases. And in the case of the CDC inspections of Texas A&M, the CDC inspectors and the inspection process is significantly outsourced to a private company, basically made sort of perfunctory observations of minor violations, and that's what typically happens, is they will find a few small things to flag. But in the case of Texas A&M, CDC inspectors were came and visited Texas A&M and gave them basically a very positive evaluation, while the researcher who had contracted Brucella was actually on both intravenous and oral antibiotics trying to kick a very nasty infection. So those events had already happened, and it was, you know, some people at Texas A&M knew of them, did not tell CDC, and CDC was not able to independently discover them.
But I believe one of the questions that came up during a press conference with Texas A&M on this issue was the question of if your organization could make document requests for incidents or accidents that had occurred there, why couldn't CDC do that themselves and find these things out?
Well, they could have, but they don't want to. We have a bit of a conflict in the U.S. in the sense that it's the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control who are the funders and conductors of this type of research, who are also playing the alleged role of being the overseers. From an institutional standpoint, the folks that are supposed to be watching over the labs in the U.S. are too close to the people who are actually funding and doing this research. We need a degree of separation that's presently not there. It doesn't surprise me at all that CDC didn't find these things on its own, because the relationship between the federal inspectors and the laboratories is not really one of is more of a collegial one than an enforcement one.
And didn't CDC shut down the Texas A&M biodefense program?
That's right. Texas A&M was actually the lead institution in the Department of Homeland Security's National Center of Excellence in foreign animal diseases of bioterrorist potential. And that program was shut down by CDC when they came to inspect the second time after a second wave of basically news releases from the Sunshine Project. And the program remains shut down right now, to my knowledge. Perhaps the second time that's happened, but we don't know because so much of the information is secret about these inspections, about this oversight. But we certainly know from the A&M case that the oversight is not very vigorous, because there were violations all over the place in College Station, and CDC didn't find them.
And that's set quite a precedent there, shutting down a program that's never been done before, to my knowledge.
We will see. Texas A&M's response was to propose to pay a $10,000 penalty. Now, under the federal law, they're liable for millions of dollars in penalties, and there are a number of their officials who are theoretically could be, you know, jailed for up to 5 years. If the federal government allows Texas A&M to get away with the slap on the wrist in terms of the penalty, I think that the message might not be a good one. But having said that, I think you're right. It certainly did send a shockwave through the academic, at least, research community to have this very public shutdown of A&M's research. But whether or not that is eventually a positive thing, which I hope it will be, still is a bit unclear, and it's going to depend upon where we go from here. I hope that with more vigorous congressional oversight, and I hope that with a greater emphasis on transparency, that this will ultimately be a good thing, but I'm reluctant to conclude that quite yet.
So there was recently a report in the AP, Associated Press, that came out about over 100 previously publicly unreported incidents. Are you familiar with that? Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, this shows how important a little bit of oversight from Congress can be. Basically, what has become apparent now is that certainly the Texas A&M and a few other, or Boston University or a few other publicly documented lab accidents, you know, at biodefense labs, were not isolated events that CDC has records on, more than 100. Of course, Texas A&M didn't report there. So in other words, the actual number of accidents could be well more than what CDC has documented. But what transpired is that there have been, contrary to the public impression, which is that this expansion of laboratories has gone with relatively few bumps along the way, that there have been a steady stream of releases of biological weapons agents and potential lab acquired infections that have just simply haven't become public knowledge. And then add to that the number of institutions that, like Texas A&M, had serious problems and just didn't tell anyone. And the picture that emerges is not that this biodefense expansion has happened without any real consequence. The picture that emerges is that on a pretty routine basis, there are people that are being exposed to or infected with biological weapons agents as a result of this expansion. Now, what hasn't happened is a outbreak in a community that's transmitted through the community. I guess the big question in my mind is that, are we going to have that before we sit down and properly regulate these facilities? I hope not. I hope that we can do it before then. And of course, in the end, we don't need 15,000 people in 400 labs in the United States handling these agents. We would be safer if there were far fewer.
You had, in your review of IBC minutes, you came across what you posed as disturbing information relating to the University of Washington and experiments there with the recreated 1918 influenza virus. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I think that, a lot of biological weapons agents, while scary and quite dangerous, don't transmit easily from human to human. There are some infectious disease agents that are unfortunately increasingly studied that do transmit easily from person to person. And so from my perspective, some of the most worrisome research that's happening in the United States right now is research on pandemic influenza in level 3 facilities, where the measures to prevent accidents are less stringent than what they could be. That's why we have level 4. Compounding that fact is that we have, in effect, created a problem for ourselves by recreating 1918 flu to begin with. It was dead. It posed no threat to anyone. It didn't exist. And between examining old medical samples and exhuming the bodies of Inuits up in Alaska, a federally funded research team actually recreated this bug. And that has a lot of implications. Now, from the defense guy's perspective, from the security guy's perspective, now we've got to figure out how to defend against this recreated bug, which wasn't a problem until we recreated it. This is the dog chasing its own tail problem. So in the case of the University of Washington, there is a lab that wants to do primate exposures to 1918 influenza, or a genetically engineered variant that in effect is 1918 influenza, or has certainly a high degree of pandemic potential. To be honest, given the fact that 1918 does not pose any natural threat, it's a bit it's a bit unjustifiable in my mind to pose this kind of risk to the community at all, because the consequences of an escape of that agent, without any exaggeration, could be tremendous. All it takes is a drop splashed in the wrong place that's not decontaminated, and it could go global and millions of people could die. And I don't, that's not hyperbole. I think we really need to weigh much more carefully the risk benefit ratio of this kind of research, particularly when it's on an influenza type that poses no natural threat.
So, talk about the public reaction to having these labs built around the country. Have generally communities been receptive or hostile to these labs?
Well, it's interesting. There's a remarkable variability. In my own home state in Texas, these labs have gone up with relatively little public opposition. Although I have to say, in San Antonio, and to a lesser extent in Galveston, where there are BSL-4 labs, the attitude seems to be changing, and I hope that maybe we're moving towards a more ongoing interest on the part of the news media and the public in knowing what's going on inside them. But nationally, there have been a number of fights over these labs. Probably the most well-known dispute is in Boston, and that's over the construction of the National Biocontainment Lab, a biosafety level 4 lab at Boston University, which a large amount of the population around this facility have been dead set against since day one. There's an ongoing battle, a lot of litigation. There were new regulations passed by the city to try to regulate this type of facility, but there's still a very active opposition that's trying to actually stop it from ever opening. And most recently, only yesterday, through that opposition, a study that was conducted by the National Research Council came out that concluded that the National Institutes of Health had seriously downplayed the sort of worst case scenarios of what could happen in terms of community infections in and around Boston in the event of an accident or a deliberate act that released an agent from the lab.
You're listening to UCYW.